today for this session, first I want to ask some questions. How many of you have ever read anything by Dorothy L. Sayers? Good portion, good. How many have read anything more than the detective fiction? Good. That'll be fun then. And I hope that, but this is going to be real loose. For those of you who have never read any Dorothy, if you've never read any, how many of you saw, Masterpiece Theater has done 4 of the Lord Peter stories. How many of you saw parts of any of those or anything? Probably on the same people that have read the stuff. But, of course, not all areas are able to get public television anymore, necessarily. We can get those. That's what we've been briefly talking about at the beginning here with some people. We were talking about how Ian Carmichael, who plays Lord Peter Wimsey on the series, doesn't quite pack it. But that's always the problem when you've read the book before you saw the movie, I guess. Today, talk a little bit about Dorothy L. Sayers. I am a fanatic, I'll tell you that. And I hope that some of in many areas, but particularly with Dorothy L. Sayers, it's really some kind of an obsession. I mean, literally, sometimes I have to, sort of go on a diet, going off her, because I'll read something by her every week and have for about the last, 5-6 years or so. I think I've read all the detective fiction. I've read Gaudy Knight about 15 times. I read it every year. And obviously I've read it more than once, about 3 times a year. So it really is an obsession. So I'm going to try and speak clearly from the midst of that kind of a situation, but I think I can. And I'll tell you about her. I'll tell you just some brief things about her life. There's a biography out about her that came out 2 years ago. It's called Such a Strange Lady. It's by a woman named Janet Hitchman. We do have these in the bookstore in paper cover. It's terrible. on most counts, it's terrible. On some counts, it's very good. One thing that's bad about it is it's very poorly written. There's been a real revival, as many of you know, partly because of the Masterpiece Theater series on, Lord Peter, but just in interest in the detective fiction again, they've gone through several reprintings in the last 4 or 5 years, and sort of a revival of reading them, probably because detective fiction and all that stuff is very popular generally right now, and this woman, Janet Hitchman, is sort of making hay while the sun shines, And one thing else about it is I noticed that after I'd read it, I do this with most books, I read through the book, and then I usually go back and read, who it's dedicated to and all that stuff, because sometimes after you've read the book, a little light's thrown on that, and that's really true here. Dorothy Sayers had a friend in college whose name was Doreen Wallace. Well, actually, they were up at the same time at Oxford, but they really got to be friends when they both worked in the same advertising agency in London. And Doreen Wallace later married a West Country farmer in London, in England, and Sayers didn't like that much because she thought that she was letting her mind go to waste by living on the farm and doing all that hard work. And then when the farmers, I think it was in the 30s, started complaining about the tithe, farmers in England are under a particular burden as far as taking care of the Church of England, in that they have to tithe according to the property they own, and it's a heavier burden than most of the other people in the country bear. And they were protesting against this. It did all get worked out eventually. But Sayers stepped into a movie theater, and they were there, they always had, back in the old days, they always had a newsreel before the main movie. And in the newsreel, here was her old friend Doreen Wallace standing in a farm cart screaming about the tithe. Well, Doreen Wallace was also an atheist, and Sayers was a Christian. And she thought a lot of screaming about the tithe was just a way to get people out of having anything to do with the church at all. And from that moment on, she disowned Doreen Wallace. And Doreen Wallace got pretty mad. Well, I read through this biography of Sayers, and then I turned around to the foreword. And I got really mad because this woman does not treat Sayers very nicely in some places. And in the dedication is to Doreen Wallace, with thanks for her boundless kindness throughout many years. So it's not an unbiased presentation. Like I said, some parts of it are good. One thing that's fun about it, if you're a Sayers freak like me, is there's a lot of stuff like correspondence and things like that in this book that you're not going to get anywhere else, from the BBC and stuff. I'll talk about a radio plays later, but And that's fun because you get some new Sayers to read. She's been dead, you know. You can't do anything. And the section on the man born to be king is especially good in this book. The woman is not a theologian, and she stayed away from the theological works, which I commend her for. At one point, she talks about, in this letter, Miss Sayers discusses her idea of the redemption of sin. Well, if it's sin that's been redeemed, we're all in trouble. So she's not very careful. Something else I wanted to say about the biography. Anyway, it's worth it. If you want to know one thing bad about learning too much about Sayers' life, I would say read Sayers, a lot of it, before you read this. Because the title is exactly, says such a strange lady, and she was a real weirdo. And I think if you read the biography first, you may be hesitant to read anything else. So I steer away from it until you've read some of the other things. And she was strange. She was born in 1893. She was the daughter of an Anglican priest who was a very magnanimous man. And really took his pastoral duties. She was an only child. I get real scared about how much I like Sayers because she was an only child who was an alto, who played the violin, and had other problems. I see. There are too many parallels there, although I'll never be a Dorothy Sayers, but you can see some connections. But, and she was educated, although much in the way that a boy would have been educated in her time. Her father taught her everything, Latin, all the stuff. And she finally went to boarding school, which she hated. And then she went to Somerville College in Oxford. And this was when women were just beginning to be admitted at Oxford University. She also sang Gilbert and Sullivan. That's another thing she did. Huh?
That's scary.
Yeah, right. Nolte's getting really scary. At least you don't play the violin here. But and she studied her major in Oxford. You don't study, you read something, and that's your major. She read French and got a first class degree in French, which is equivalent of a magna cum laude degree in our country. However, she did not get her degree until 1920, because although they allowed women into Oxford, they wouldn't give them degrees until 1920. Then they had this great huge ceremony, and all the women that had graduated since about 1890 were all given their degrees. So it took a while. After she graduated from Oxford, she went to London, and World War I broke in there too. She did a couple things. She taught in France for a while and came back, and finally ended up in an advertising agency where she was for almost 10 years. And one of her novels, Murder Must Advertise, is based on that. And it was during this time that she began writing the Lord Peter books, which are the most famous, and I'll talk about them briefly to begin with. There are 11 novels, and all starring Lord Peter Wimsey, who is, as she described him in one place, an 18th century Whig gentleman born a little bit out of his time. He's an aristocrat that has plenty of money at his disposal, does all kinds of things like plays Bach on the piano and collects rare editions of books, and he has a servant named Bunter who is terrific. Some people were mentioning here the books are worth it for Bunter, who is also his partner in detecting crimes. And the one thing about the detective fiction itself is detective fiction at its peak. Some people have said it's second only to Conan Doyle in its construction, only second to the Sherlock Holmes stuff. They're marvelous stories. Sayers was a very straightforward detective writer. When you read the books, all the clues are there for you. She doesn't play any tricks on you at all. And if you're smart, yeah. If you're good at doing that, you can pick them up. But the other thing that's really good about them is that they're also very good novels. In fact, in many of them, the detective stuff is almost secondary to just the fact of the plot itself and the fact that they're very well written and all this stuff. Some people also complain about Sayers, and she's complaining about in her time that she wrote for a select group of people. And in a sense, she did. And she says at one point that I'd like to write the kind of detective fiction that the academic can take on the train and read and not have to put a brown paper wrapper around. So they wouldn't be embarrassed that they were a scholar and reading this stuff. And so in many of them, there are long passages in French and some quotes in Latin and stuff that she does not translate. And, of course, for the educated person in England of her time, that's part of their education, is you would have learned Latin and French in school and would be able to read them. However, it's very possible to read the novels without knowing either Latin or French. You know, it's almost frills, except for the last two lines of Gaudy Night happen to be in Latin. And that makes people very mad, except for that even in that context, you know precisely what has happened.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, don't you? Yeah, you got that. You don't know exactly what it says.
Especially if you read the next book.
Especially if you read the next book, yeah, right. Which is another thing, I'm speaking of, they're saying read the next book. I think it's important to read them in order. Because she's a very, very good writer, and she develops the character of Lord Peter very well. And he changes greatly between Whose Body and Busman's Honeymoon. And she's very careful that he advances in age. The way he advances in age doesn't necessarily correspond to the space between the books. But that's the writer's. Some people say that, and I think that's just stupid. I mean, that's her liberty. I mean, she could have written a book 5 years later, and Lord Peter could only be 1 year older than he was in the last book, and that doesn't make any difference. But, you know, he develops very well. So the first one's Whose Body, and some people get turned off right away because it starts out, and it says, "Damn," said Lord Peter loudly. And that raised some eyebrows when it was written in the early 20s there, too. So it's fun. But there are four that you must read in order. That absolutely have to be read in order. I will be very adamant on this point. And they are Strong Poison, Have His Carcass, Gaudy Night, and Busman's Honeymoon. And that's because in Strong Poison, she introduces a character named Harriet Vane, who also happens to be a writer of detective fiction, who's on trial for a life, and Lord Peter steps in and falls in love. So all four of those books are the building of that relationship. And she does it very well. It's a very normal kind of relationship. You know, it's not your usual kind of, oh, they fell in love and everything, you know, and they lived happily ever after. No, it takes 5 years for them to work out all their problems and do all this. And so it's a very, you know, she's very realistic, which is a lot of fun, too.
You list those four.
Okay, Strong Poison, Have His Carcass, Gaudy Night, and Busman's Honeymoon.
Thank you.
And between Strong Poison and Have His Carcass comes in between. There are other novels in between those, except for Gaudy Night and Busman's Honeymoon come in order as far as the books go. And all the novels are in order in our bookstore. All the novels. She also wrote some other things in detective lines. She wrote, there's a book called The Documents on the Case, where she collaborated with a scientist named Robert Eustace, and who she also used to help her out with some little technicalities with poisonings and all and things like that in some of the other books. And that's a very interesting book. It's a whole series of correspondence between some people who lived in flats that were up above each other. And, you know, it's one of these love triangle kind of situations where a young artist falls in love with the young wife of a very strange man. And it's fun. Lord Peter does not appear anywhere. The best thing it's fun for, I think, is Sayers. I'll say this, first of all, Sayers just as a person and as a Christian person really took Jesus' command seriously to be in the world but not of it. And with her imaginative style is able to perceive the world around her just delightfully, you know. We're really stepping back and looking at it, but at the same time knowing that she lives in that. And it's very, very good. And the documents in the case, and because of that, she was able to talk, to stereotype people in society in a way that's not offensive, saying, well, all those people are the same. It's not that kind of stereotyping. It's a descriptive type of stereotyping where she can say, look at how this person behaves and how that functions in society. And it's really fun. The documents in the case is just excellent that way, talking about artists and poets and what was going on in the 30s in England, and I think that's pretty true also of this country, just in the world, and the kinds of things that were going on. She talks a lot about, there's a whole passage in there about scientists learning to make, you know, human beings in test tubes and all that kind of stuff. And she does that very well. So that's a fun book. There are also three volumes of short stories, Hangman's Holiday, Lord Peter Views the Body, and In the Teeth of the Evidence. And in two of those volumes, the last two I mentioned, she introduces a new character, and she has several short stories on a wine merchant whose name is Montague Egg and who quotes things out of the salesman's handbook. And he's really fun, very different from Lord Peter. And the stories aren't quite as good as the Lord Peter ones. Another interesting thing, and Harper and Row have this. This is good. We don't have it at Holden. We should get some more, but it is. You can get it in any bookstore. It's just called Lord Peter, and this is all the short stories about Lord Peter. And it's a fun volume to have. The short stories are very different from the novels. I think it takes a lot of skill, you literature people can back me up, to write a very good short story. Maybe even more so. It's a consummate skill to do that very well. And Sayers just doesn't bother. And in the short stories, Lord Peter's a little disappointing sometimes because he becomes a little more flamboyant. You know, he runs around shooting people and, you know, he carries a gun, which he never does in any of the novels. And he gets involved in huge international incidents and that kind of thing, and very bizarre kinds of things, like dealing with an artist who had made an Art Deco statue out of his, by copper plating his mistress. And, you know, there are more things. But Sayers, it's interesting, because what comes out in these short stories is her own, she also wrote a short book called Human and Inhuman Stories and was very, very interested in occult kind of stuff, not so much for herself, but you know, horror stories, stories of terror, you know, of the mysterious and all kinds of weird things that people do and that happens to them. She was real interested in that. And it comes out more in the short stories than anything else. She also edited a book called The Omnibus of Crime, where she talks about the art of writing detective fiction and sketches the history of detective fiction from, way back in, you know, in mystery stories, way back in, you know, from the Greeks right on through, modern times. And that's fun. You can probably find that in a library somewhere. It's called The Omnibus of Crime. Let's see, what else about the novels? Oh, the fun thing about the novels, she worked very hard on these. She did it for fun and profit, literally. You know, she knew it was going to be prosperous to do it. But she, this is one of the novels, but they're really, they're good books. Right, Carol?
Yeah,
they are. They're very good books. They're well written and all that kind of stuff.
She uses English beautifully.
Beautifully, yeah, she really does. And I'm going to sort of tantalize you, I'm just going to read you one section from Unnatural Death, which is the third of the novels, and to sort of get you, so we can sort of move from this into some of her religious writings, because this does some things. It comes up, you know, she was a Christian. One thing she would hate is if you'd take her novels and say, well, this is what Dorothy Sayers believes, because this is what she had Lord Peter do. Or have Harriet Vane do. And that's also the problem of the biographies. That's precisely what this woman does. But this is a... Lord Peter is walking into a church. He did not spend too much time in church. Except for he read the lesson at home. And some of her descriptions are really fun. He's looking for a woman named Miss Clemson, who runs a place called the Cattery, which Lord Peter discovered that the most unused source of energy in England was spinster power. And he set up this place called the Cattery. That's what he called it, but it was ostensibly a typing agency. And he engaged all these elderly spinsters who had spent their whole lives in boarding houses. And he said, if anyone knows how to get information out of people, they do. And just because they've had a whole life of it. Anyway, Miss Clemson is terrific. She's a terrific character, and she's sort of the head of this typing bureau. And she writes Lord Peter all these messages, and they all have italicized words. You know, she underlines everything, and it's really fun. He's looking for her because she's gotten herself into some difficulties trying to get in touch with this woman they think is the culprit. And Miss Clemson's biggest problem when she hits these boarding houses, you know, in England there's the high church people, they called them church, and then there was chapel, which were essentially the Methodists, the nonconformists they also called them, and every town always had church and chapel, and they always referred to the high church Anglicans as Roman Catholics, which was in England a great abominable thing to say, and Miss Clemson was one of these Roman Catholics, and Lord Peter looking for her went to the landlady of the boarding house she was staying in, and I just wanted to say this to you, but... She said, this is really good. It gives you an idea of Sayer's whole attitude towards Christianity. She says to Peter, but indeed, sir, she added, if you was quick, you might find her up at the church. She often drops in there to say her prayers like, not a respectful way to approach a place of worship. To my mind, you think so yourself, sir? Popping in and out on a weekday, the same as if it was a friend's house. And coming home from communion as cheerful as anything and ready to laugh and make jokes. I don't see as how we was meant to make an ordinary thing of religion that way. So disrespectful and nothing uplifting to the heart about it. But there, we all have our failings, and Miss Clemson is a nice lady, and that I must say, even if she is a Roman Catholic or next door to one. I love that Roman Catholic. And anyway, then Peter goes into the church to find Miss Clemson, and it says, the doors of St. Onesimus were hospitably open, and the red sanctuary lamp made a little spot of welcoming brightness in the rather dark building. Coming in from the June sunshine, Whimsy blinked a little before he could distinguish anything else. Presently, he was able to make out a dark, bowed figure kneeling before the lamp. For a moment, he hoped it was Miss Clemson, but presently he saw to his disappointment that it was merely a sister in a black habit, presumably taking her turn to watch before the host. The only other occupant in the church was a priest in a cassock who was busy with the ornaments on the high altar. It was the Feast of St. John, Whimsy remembered suddenly. He walked up the aisle, hoping to find his quarry hidden in some obscure corner. His shoes squeaked. This annoyed him. It was a thing which Bunter never permitted. He was seized with the fancy that the squeak was produced by diabolical possession, a protest against the religious atmosphere on the part of his own particular besetting devil. Pleased with this thought, he moved forward more confidently. The priest's attention was attracted by the squeak. He turned and came down towards the intruder, no doubt, thought Whimsy, to offer his professional services to exorcise the evil spirit. Were you looking for anybody? Inquired the priest courteously. Well, I was looking for a lady, began Whimsy. Then it struck him that this sounded a little odd under the circumstances, and he hastened to explain more fully in the stifled tones considered appropriate to consecrated surroundings. Oh, yes, said the priest quite unperturbed. Miss Clemson was here a little time ago, but I fancy she is gone. Not that I usually keep tabs on my flock, he added with a laugh, but she spoke to me before she went. Was it urgent? What a pity you should have missed her. Can I give any kind of message or help you in any way? No, thanks, said Whimsy. Sorry to bother you. Unseemly to come and try to haul people out of church. But, yes, it was rather important. I'll leave a message at the house. Thanks frightfully. He turned away, then stopped and came back. I say, he said, you could give advice on moral problems and all that sort of thing. Well, we're supposed to try, said the priest. Is anything bothering you in particular? Yes, said Whimsy. Nothing religious, I don't mean. Nothing about the infallibility of the Virgin Mary or anything of that sort. Just something I'm not comfortable about. The priest, who was in fact the vicar, Mr. Treadgold, indicated that he was quite at Lord Peter's service. It's very good of you. Could we come somewhere where I didn't have to whisper so much? I never can explain things in a whisper. Sort of paralyzes one, don't you know? Let's go outside, said Mr. Treadgold. And then, let's see. It's like this, said Whimsy. Hypothetical case, you know, and so on. Supposing one knows somebody who's very, very ill and can't last long anyhow. And they're in awful pain and all that, and kept under morphia, practically dead to the world, you know. And suppose that by dying straight away, they could make something happen which they really wanted to happen, and which couldn't happen if they lived on a little longer. I can't explain exactly how, because I don't want to give personal details and so on. You get the idea? Well, supposing somebody who knew all that was just to give them a little push off, so to speak, hurry matters on. Why should that be a very dreadful crime? The law, began Mr. Treadgold. Oh, the law says it's a crime, fast enough, said Whimsy. But do you honestly think it's very bad? I know you'd call it a sin, of course, but why is it so very dreadful? It doesn't do the person any harm, does it? We can't answer that, said Mr. Treadgold, without knowing the ways of God with the soul. In those last weeks or hours of pain and unconsciousness, the soul may be undergoing some necessary part of its pilgrimage on earth. It isn't our business to cut it short. Who are we to take life and death into our hands? Well, we do it all day, one way and another, juries, soldiers, doctors, all that. And yet I do feel somehow that it isn't the right thing in this case. And yet, by interfering, finding things out, and so on, one may do far worse harm, start all kinds of things. I think, said Mr. Treadgold, that the sin, I won't use that word, the damage to society, that says something else about sayers too, the wrongness of the thing lies much more in the harm it does the killer than anything it can do to the person who was killed. Especially, of course, if the killing is to the killer's own advantage. The consequence you mentioned, this thing which the sick person wants done, does the other person stand to benefit by it? Nicholson, I won't read much more because you'll get too many clues as to what the book's about if you haven't read it. But I think that that's a really important thing about one reason. Sayers wrote them, like I said, for fun and profit, but she's also saying some very important things about the human condition. I mean, you can see in that that she's saying some things that we could listen to in our own day in the whole abortion and euthanasia stuff. And the one thing about the novels is that it really gets you back to a good, solid notion of plain old, ordinary sin, you know? What happens in these books are, these are the crimes that could be committed by any of us, huh? By the person next door to you, by anything. They're all, you know, if you took the seven deadly sins from the Middle Ages, each novel sort of plays on each of these. You know, probably greed is the biggest one. Jealousy is one that in one of the novels is the most prominent thing. Lust is a biggie, you know, all of them. And they're just, it's the heightening of, you know, the sin that gets out of control and then causes the person to go do the crime. And Sayers deals with this very, very well in all the novels. You know, I hate to put a big theological burden on you when you read them, but I think that you'll find that in that very well. I just want to put in a plug for Gaudy Night. It's long before I go on to something else. This is my personal favorite. I've been known to say that if I had to go away and was only allowed two books, it would be the Bible and Gaudy Night. It's splendid. Sometimes it's too long. There's a whole lot of jargon in it about university life at Oxford that, you know, you can just pass over. You won't understand it, a lot of it. You might want to read a book about how colleges function in England or something beforehand, or go to the Encyclopedia Britannica or something and look up Oxford. But it's a great book. There is no murder in this book. It's a very interesting crime, and she raises some very, very interesting questions. I'll just leave it at that. A schoolboy once in an essay for a class in England said, "Then there was Miss Dorothy L. Sayers, who left a life of crime to join the Church of England." And that's one thing that could be said about, she got tired of Lord Peter, although the public was demanding more and more. During World War II, she put out a series called The Whimsy Papers, in which Whimsy and his new family, Harriet and Whimsy, do get married. You can know that eventually. And, you know, discuss the war problems and things like this in correspondence. But what she really wanted to do all the time was to write from a Christian perspective about theology. And she did that, like I said, in the Lord Peter books. But she did it then after that to a greater degree. And nothing was published. There's no particular order things come in and stuff. This is a book that was published about 10 years ago in this country. It's out of print right now, but you can find it in the library somewhere. It's called Christian Letters to a Post-Christian World. It's a very excellent, excellent collection of essays by Dorothy Sayers. And I'm going to read you one little thing. Sayers was a great, great satirist, too. She's a very funny lady, very funny. And she thought the greatest religion of the 20th century was the religion of modernity, of technology, worshiping the gods of man. And she has, in the beginning of this, there's a thing called the Pantheon Papers, where she puts together a whole series. There's a color picture here, too, which is nice. It's called The Calendar of Unholy and Dead Letter Days, and puts together a whole church year for the religion of modernity. It has some great things like the Venerable Bernard Shaw is one of the saints, one of the saints' days. Another one is the beautification of Saint Henna. Do you all know the henna is hair dye? Saint Mark's the evangelist, who was holding his fingers up and has Das Kapital in his thing. St. Julian the polymath, that's after Julian Huxley, who was a scientist in England and pushed a lot of, you know, really modern ideas and stuff like that. The fiery loins of St. Lawrence, D.H. And St. Sigmund Freud, sublimine. there are a whole bunch of, All Fool's Day is another big one. The apotheosis of the common man, commonly called Lowbrow Sunday. And there's a whole lot of stuff. But she wrote a hymn. And I'll open this next little section on with this hymn. It's called For an Evening Service. It's suitable for the vigil of the enlightenment. It goes like this. The tune's in our hymnal, too, if you ever want to sing it. The day that nature gave his ending, the hand of man turns on the light. We thank thee, progress, for defending our nerves against the dreadful night. As o'er each continent and island the switches spread synthetic day, the noise of mirth is never silent, nor dies the strain of toil away. We thank thee that thy speed incessant provides upon this whirling ball no time to brood on things unpleasant, no time, in fact, to think at all. Secure amid the soothing riot of crank and soundtrack, plane and car, we shall not be condemned to quiet, nor left alone with what we are. By lavish and progressive measures, our neighbor's wants are all relieved. We are not called to share his pleasures, and in his grief we are not grieved. The winged wheels o'erspan the oceans, machining out the standard man. Our food, our learning, our emotions are processed for us in the can. All bars of color, caste, and nation must yield to movies and the mic. We need not seek communication, for thou dost make us all alike. So be it. Let nor sleep nor slackness impede thy progress, light sublime, nor ever let us glimpse the blackness that yawns behind the gates of time. And I think that's a very good statement about the 20th century. And her biggest thing about that she wanted to push about Christian faith, and one of her big lines, is that the dogma is the drama. And she said that well-meaning curates and other people of that sort had watered down the Christian gospel to such a point that it was no longer exciting to anybody.
One.
Not one bit of it. And where's this? I want to read, I'm reading from this book here, about one thing about all this. I'm trying to just give you a little taste by reading all this stuff of what everything she's about. The one biggest, there are two biggest contributions she made in terms of theology. One is indeed theology itself. It's a book called The Mind of the Maker, which is also out of print. But these things, you know, when I say they're out of print right now, they tend to come back about every 5 or 6 years. There are two biggest contributions she made in terms of theology. One is indeed theology itself. It's a book called The Mind of the Maker, which is also out of print. But these things, you know, when I say they're out of print right now, they tend to come back about every 5 or 6 years. And hopefully this one will be. Warren Quambeck at Luther Seminary says that this book, The Mind of the Maker, is the most comprehensive and perhaps the best written book about the history of the doctrine of the Trinity that's been written in the 20th century. And it's just excellent. She equates the mind of maker God with the mind of the human maker, talks about the Trinity in terms of the creator and the power, the Son, and the energy, the Spirit. And that's the same way a writer works, and she uses her own experience, and it's very, very, very good. I recommend that highly. It's kind of heavy, but it's fun. It's not as heavy as most other theological tomes you might pick up. And the other big thing she did was to write a play called The Man Born to Be King. Maybe you've heard about this. We have this in our bookstore here. It was a radio play that was put on first at the end of the 40s in England. The BBC commissioned her to do it. She had a whole lot of hassles about it. Her biggest intent was to make the gospel narrative come alive for the people in her day. And in it, she used, like, all the people talked in all the different various dialects of England, you know. And so they were familiar kinds of people, could place them as far as, you know, a Cockney or a Welsh person or what have you. And it's exciting to read. One thing I'd recommend, we have, like I said, we have in the store, that one is continually in print. It's always in great demand. It's put on in England. It was put on every year for 4 years until Sayers put a stop to it and said, this is ridiculous. They're getting tired of it. And it's put on still about every 2 years or so in England on the radio, and it is a radio play. And one fun thing to do that I know a lot of people have done in their churches is to take The Man Born to Be King and to read it just during Lent with a group of people. Just read through the whole thing. Or during Christmas, do it in two parts. Do the Christmas part and the Lent and Easter part. I'm going to read you part of a letter she wrote to the BBC about The Man Born to Be King and the problem she was having taking the gospel narrative and making it make sense, you know, on the radio, first of all, which is a problem, and then also making it sense in the idioms of the day. And there's a lot of real fun stuff here, and this should give you a feeling of how she approached what she wanted to do about really reviving the drama of the gospel. It's such a nuisance, she says, not to be able to introduce, say, an elderly Pharisee suddenly without having someone say, in effect, remember this is on the radio, the voice that you are going to hear is that of a Pharisee, and he is elderly. And to remember that if more than three people take part in a conversation at once, the audience will get them hopelessly mixed up. That's the trouble I always suffer from when listening to a radio play, especially if all the voices are of the same sex. As we get on into the ministry, the overwhelming maleness of everybody is going to be a great trial. The ministry, meaning Jesus, it's ministry in capital letters. One can't help wishing that Christ's female acquaintances had been a little more varied and respectable. One can't do much for children with the woman taken in adultery, or the lady who had had 7 husbands, of whom the latest, and probably all the others, was of very dubious status, or with Mary Magdalene, except by giving a general impression that she lived a fast life and probably had too many cocktails. Who, I wonder, was Salome, who suddenly turned up at the graveside? I'm going to make her an old friend of John the Baptist people, and so get her place at the start. And I'm making Judas turn up early, too. He lived at Kerioth and was a follower of John. But when he saw that Jesus was, so to speak, the coming man, he hitched his wagon to that star. His idea was to bring in the kingdom socially and politically, and he saw in Jesus the sort of inspired idiot who could be at once a leader and a tool, rather like Hitler to the Ribbentrops and the Goerings. I don't mean that Judas intended anything as sinister as the Ribbentrops, but that he envisaged that kind of relationship. He falls, in fact, to the very temptation that Christ resists in the wilderness, that of using the kingdoms of the world to bring in the kingdom of God. Therefore, he will have much the most practical turn of mind of all the disciples, and that is why they put him in charge of the bag. Now, he was the treasurer, kind of. So far, so good, and Christ accepts him. But there must always be some contact between the kingdom and the world, and there must be, in a church, somebody with practical ability. But with that sort of person, there is always from the beginning the danger of corruption, which duly occurs. That seems to fit in all right, and has the proper sort of tragic inevitability. But how all this is going to be got over to the youthful mind, I don't know. There's nothing very simple about the simple gospel when you look into it. It's about adult people, and it's all very complex. And she says, golly, this is a job. Look at all those 12 disciples, and we know nothing about most of them. John has a personality, and Peter and Judas and Thomas Didymus, James, Philip, and Andrew have about 2 lines of piece which throw no light on their characters, and they all have to be assembled and talk plausibly in the upper room. The gospel must be a narrative of fact. Nobody inventing a story could be so vague and slipshod about the dramatis personae. I think that's really a fine comment. I'm going to tell you briefly what we have available here, because we're getting a little late, and I want some other get a little bit of discussion about some people that have read some of the other things. Like I said, this is just real quick. I could talk for hours and hours and hours, but we don't want to do that. In the bookstore, we have all the whimsy novels, all the short story books, and the documents in the case on the fiction side. And we have a book called A Matter of Eternity, which is edited by a woman named Rosamond Kent Sprague, who teaches at the University of North Carolina. And what it is she's taken, gone through all, she's a fanatic also, and she's gone through all the literature. She uses even stuff from, like that section I read from Unnatural Death, she uses that. And all the theological essays of Sayers. And she's put together sort of a book of meditations based on them. And it's, she put them under categories like sin and love and hate and death and the cross and dogma, things like this. But it's a really, really good introduction to Sayers. And even if you might not be so inclined to sit down and read through one of the essays or to read The Mind of the Maker or something like that, I highly recommend A Matter of Eternity for you, because she's done a very, very good job of really pulling the gems from Sayers' writings and put them into nice categories. And all of them are only about a paragraph long, which means that you can just sort of pick it up and read it every other week or something. Which is nice. Sayers is a very good writer, which means when you sit down to read something by her, you'll find immediately, I think, that you're not going to be able to read anything else in between. She's tight, you know, that wonderful word they use for writing. No, you almost have to sit down and read the whole thing, especially the theological essay, that's very important. Most of them are brief, which is nice. But another thing Sayers was, that I'd just like to read one of the, we have A Man Born to be King in there also, and we also have this little book called Are Women Human, which is 2 little lectures she gave in the 30s to a couple societies in London. And Dorothy Sayers, she would not have called herself a feminist in terms of the way we describe the feminist movement today. However, she thought that the way women were treated was ridiculous and rather silly. And being a very independent, stubborn sort of woman herself, who really did get her own way and made her way in the world according to her own plan, she had some very definite things to say about it, and she thought that people should shape up. So I'm just going to read you a couple little fun things from here, which, and remember, this is really, 30 years before, the feminist movement as we know it got going. And she says, let me see. She talked about the problem of, you know, that women, you know, women like certain things, advertisers use it. Women like certain things, men like certain things. Women are to behave in certain ways, men are to behave in certain ways. And she says, this is just really crazy. And she says, it's this for men. Probably no man has ever troubled to imagine how strange his life would appear to himself if it were unrelentingly assessed in terms of his maleness. If everything he wore, said, or did had to be justified by reference to female approval. If he were compelled to regard himself day in and day out, not as a member of society, but merely as a virile member of society. If the center of his dress consciousness were the codpiece, his education directed to making him a spirited lover and meek paterfamilias, his interests held to be natural only insofar as they were sexual. If from school and lecture room, press and pulpit, he heard the persistent outpouring of a shrill and scolding voice bidding him remember his biological function. If he were vexed by continual advice how to add a rough male touch to his typing, how to be learned without losing his masculine appeal, how to combine chemical research with seduction, how to play bridge without incurring the suspicion of impotence. If, instead of allowing with a smile that women prefer cavemen, he felt the unrelenting pressure of a whole social structure forcing him to order all his goings in conformity with that pronouncement. His newspaper would assist him with a men's corner, telling him how, by the expenditure of a good deal of money and a couple hours a day, he could attract the girls and retain his wife's affection. And when he had succeeded in capturing a mate, his name would be taken from him, and society would present him with a special title to proclaim his achievement. People would write books called History of the Male, or Males of the Bible, or The Psychology of the Male, and he would be regaled daily with headlines such as Gentleman Doctor's Discovery, Male Secretary Wins Calcutta Sweep, Men Artists at the Academy. If he gave an interview to a reporter or performed any unusual exploit, he would find it recorded in such terms as these. Professor Bracht, although a distinguished botanist, is not in any way an unmanly man. He has, in fact, a wife and seven children. Tall and burly, with hands which he handles as delicate specimens, are as gnarled and powerful as those of a Canadian lumberjack. And when I swilled beer with him in his laboratory, he bawled his conclusions at me in a strong, gruff voice that implemented the promise of his swaggering mustache. Or, there is nothing in the least feminine about the home surroundings of Mr. Focus, the famous children's photographer. His den is paneled in teak and decorated with rude sculptures from Easter Island. Over his austere iron bedstead hangs a fine reproduction of the Rape of the Sabines. Or I asked M. Sapristi, the renowned chef, whether kitchen cult was not a rather unusual occupation for a man. Not a bit of it, he replied bluffly. It is the genius that counts, not the sex. As they say in La Belle Ecosse, a man's a man for that, and his gusty, manly guffaw blew three small patty pans from the dresser. He would be edified by solemn discussions about should men serve in drapery establishments, and acrimonious ones about tea-drinking men, by cross-shots of public affairs from the masculine angle, and by irritable correspondence about men who expose their anatomy on beaches, so masculine of them, conceal it in dressing gowns, too feminine of them, think about nothing but women, pretend a natural indifference to women, exploit their sex to get jobs, lower the tone of the office by their sexless appearance, and generally fail to please the public opinion which demands the incompatible. And at dinner parties, he would hear the wheedling, unctuous, predatory female voice demand, and why should you trouble your handsome little head about politics? Anyway, at the end of this, she says some very good things about the gospel and women. She's going on. She says, God, of course, may have his own opinion. But the church is reluctant to endorse it. I think I have never heard a sermon preached on the story of Martha and Mary that did not attempt somehow, somewhere, to explain away its text. Mary's, of course, was the better part. The Lord said so, and we must not precisely contradict him. But we will be careful not to despise Martha. No doubt he approved of her, too. We could not get on without her, and indeed, having paid lip service to God's opinion, we must admit that we greatly prefer her. For Martha was doing a really feminine job, whereas Mary was just behaving like any other disciple, male or female, and that is a hard pill to swallow. Perhaps it is no wonder that the women were first at the cradle and last at the cross. They had never known a man like this man. There never has been such another. A prophet and teacher who never nagged at them, never flattered or coaxed or patronized, who never made arch jokes about them, never treated them either as the women, God help us, or the ladies, God bless them, who rebuked without querulousness and praised without condescension, who took their questions and arguments seriously, who never mapped out their sphere for them, never urged them to be feminine or jeered at them for being female, who had no axe to grind and no uneasy male dignity to defend, who took them as he found them and was completely unselfconscious. There is no act, no sermon, no parable in the whole gospel that borrows its pungency from female perversity. Nobody could possibly guess from the words and deeds of Jesus that there was anything funny about woman's nature. But we might easily deduce it from his contemporaries and from his prophets before him and from his church to this day. Women are not human. Nobody shall persuade that they are human. Let them say what they like. We will not believe it, though one rose from the dead. I think that says things pretty well. That's a good little book to have around, I think. Are women human? Yeah, that's fine. We have a bunch of them in the bookstore. I have yacked on too long. But maybe some of the others that have read some sayers, if you want to ask me some questions, shoot.
Nancy, her translation of Dante's.
Oh, yeah. The last thing she did in her life was to translate.
It's in the bookstore
also. Yeah. We just got 10 copies of all three. Translated Dante's Inferno. The scholars around her got furious. Or the Dante's Divine Comedy. I'm sorry, the Inferno is just the first one. But, and all the scholars around her got mad because she didn't have her, you know, she didn't have the credentials to do that. She got started on it during an air raid during World War II, and every time she'd go down to their bomb shelter, whenever the doodlebugs, as they call them, came by, she just grabbed the first book that she got, and she got down there and discovered that she had a copy of the Divine Comedy in medieval Latin, I mean, Italian, you know. And she didn't know Italian, but she figured out that she could read it by, she knew plenty, you know, she knew Latin fine, in French, she's fluent in both. And by combining those, she could put the Italian together. And she got fascinated. She'd always liked Dante. And she decided to do a new translation that would really bring, just like she wanted to do with the gospel, bring Dante home to the modern mind. And there's still a lot of criticisms about her translation because some people say it's sloppy and stuff, and it's not scholarly. You know, that's what gets them.
That's what's good about it.
That's what's good about it, too. You know, Dante's really important to read. He's a really important pivot point for a lot of Christian theology, particularly Christian poetry and writing and stuff like that that followed him. Really important. And I think all of us sort of shy away from reading Dante, you know, because it's so hard to do. But Sayers, it's eminently approachable. Very easy to read. It's a little hard for an American sometimes because many of the idioms she uses are particularly British, you know, which is nice. But the books are worth it simply for her comments, you know. You can just read the comments even without having, she wouldn't like that very well, but and get a real feeling for Dante. They're just excellent. Another thing about Dante and Sayers that should be said is that she was also sort of a half member of a group called the Inklings, which surrounded a man called Charles Williams. We also have his novels in there in the bookstore, which are interesting. I will get into that. Anyway, and also included C.S. Lewis, Owen Barfield, Gervis Matthews, a few other people that we all know. J.R.R. Tolkien, you may know all those names. Lewis, particularly, I know is very famous. And Sayers was sort of half in and half out of that group. Part of it was she did not live in Oxford. She lived in London. And so, but when she got up there, they let her come, except for they only drank tea with her. They drank beer with themselves. As Lewis said, with Charles Williams, he only saw Miss Sayers drink tea, but that was neither her fault nor his. So, but that's the last thing she did. In fact, she died before she finished the last volume. And her collaborator in that was a woman named Barbara Reynolds, who taught at Cambridge University and taught medieval literature. And they met late on in Dorothy's process in the translation. But Barbara Reynolds got so involved in it that she finished the third volume, and it's impossible to tell, you know, where Sayers leaves off and Reynolds picks up. You know, she was so involved with what Dorothy Sayers was doing. So that's fun.
I think it's interesting that John Ciardi was one of her major critics when she about her attempts at translation of Dante, because he said that nobody could possibly do the Terza Rima. And the reason he said that is that he tried and couldn't do it himself and came out with a prose version. And now he's redone it, and has come out with the Terza Rima. But it still isn't as good as
her. Terza Rima is the form of the poetry that Dante, the rhyme scheme Dante wrote in. And Sayers did that. She made an attempt to translate and succeeded. I think that's probably why also the scholars got really mad, because nobody managed it very successfully before. You know, and if you don't have the credentials, of course, you can't do it. You know. What's going on? Anything else? She also, when she was in college, she began to translate the Song of Roland, which is a French epic thing. And she finally came out with that in print. Also, in the midst of the Dante thing, she finished her translation of the Song of Roland that she had begun 50 years before, which is also readily available if you're into reading the Song of Roland.
Is that in print?
Yes, yeah. It's still in print. Penguin.
Penguin, yeah.
And it's American Penguin, too, which is nice. It's not just British Penguin. Anything else anybody else wants to say or add? Or do you want to read Sayers?
Yeah, if you find a copy of Creator Chaos in an old bookstore, buy it.
Yeah, anytime you're in an old bookstore and you find any Sayers, grab it. If you don't want it, you can send it to me. I hope that I've gotten you enthused, those of you that have never read any Dorothy Sayers. Dorothy L. Sayers, please. I have to keep remembering to do that. She was very adamant about the use of her middle initial. And she used to write these just scathing letters. I marked one. We don't really have time to read it, but, you know, she said, they never referred to George Shaw. Why can't I have my middle initial, you know? It's been managed before. And in this one letter, she talks about how in advertising it comes out Dorothy Sayers and all over the place. And she said, even my publisher, Mr. Golant, has gone back on me in his advertisements. And she said, what am I to do if even he goes back on me? And at one point, she writes to the BBC, they had advertised The Man Born to be King by a Miss Dorothy Sayers. Well, she was married, too, by the way, although she retained her maiden name. Not a particular, wouldn't be called one of your
all-time great
marriages. But anyway, she wrote and she says, if you insist on advertising my name as Dorothy Sayers, I'm going to remove myself from the production completely, in fact, take away all rights to it. Dorothy Sayers is one of your employees that plays the banjo or the ukulele or dances in a chorus line. She's very adamant about it. One letter she talks about it, she said, call it a Freudian schoolgirl complex if you want. But she had very unpleasant associations with being called Dorothy Sayers. So she wanted her L in there. So it was Dorothy L. Sayers at all times.
One of the things I remember about one of her essays in Post-Christian Letters is the...
Christian Letters.
Post-Christian World. Is her talking about Plato and talking about what art does in revealing oneself to oneself. It was just the way she put it in the essay and that's always stuck with me. I'm sure, I know it's not particularly a new notion, but how she did it, it came clear to me. And when I think about whatever piece of art is in film or book or whatever, I really refer back to her a lot.
Yeah.
And I also liked her essay, which I can't remember much about, on Oedipus. But she deals with fate. She doesn't deal with the Oedipal complex. It's more what
it's called Oedipus Simplex.
Yeah, that's right. Simplex. It's really a fun one because she really talks about fate and how people deal with fate or whatever that means. And the Oedipus story, she really doesn't take it the Freudian view about a guy loving his mother and all that. It's how the fates, do you prepare if you know something's going to happen or not prepare or whatever. And I thought that was really... That's something I remember. I don't ever remember very much.
Yeah, that's one thing about her stuff, you know. It's eminently readable. And explains herself very well.
I'm just starting to reread Dorothy Sayers' Spring, and I'm not as good at remembering which title goes with which story as you are. But I thought there's one about a drug ring.
Murder Mustache.
And I thought, gee, how modern. I mean, here it was written in the 30s or
so.
Well, and it really fits right now. Or it's just amazing how even with the British idiom and everything else, it fits into 20th century American situation.
Yeah, very, very, it's amazing.
That's also the one where the cricket match goes on three pages and I didn't understand a word of it.
See, don't I, but let me, I want to make a plea for the cricket match. Cricket match, Murder Must Advertise. And Murder Must Advertise is one of my favorites of all the novels. It's really fun. Well, she worked in an advertising agency, and so she just has all the stuff, you know, and Polk's great fun at advertisers, you know, and at our commercial life and our materialistic situation. Really great. And, but there's a cricket match in it between, Lord Peter becomes a, he take, takes on a different name and becomes works in this advertising agency. Literally, it's the first time he's ever earned any money in his life, and that's kind of fun too. But when I read Murder Must Advertise, I read it really slowly. I just wait for that cricket match because it's just terrific. See, Lord Peter was a terrific cricketer, and you can't let him know who he is because everybody knows Whimsy of Balliol, you know, and the great cricket match of whatever it was. Anyway, and it's really fun. I won't tell you what happens at the end of it, but you know, I don't understand a thing about cricket. Not one thing.
I try to get somebody in England to tell me about the rules, and there was an argument around the table. I finally left because everybody. No, it isn't that way. You know?
But you can read it and enjoy it. You have no idea what's going on, but unless you really know what cricket's about, which, and like Carol pointed out, even the English don't know. So, but when Lord Peter finally.
I like that it does it. The teams too in a company or who could really play, who are the real athletes.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
In the advertising.
Yeah, it's really.
About who's on the list?
Who's on the list? Yeah, it's fun. Anybody have any other? It seems to me I had something else that I could.
I think the book Creeds in the Making is a different. People may have two. You hear somebody say, "Well, I don't even say the creeds anymore because they're man-made and I don't understand."
Yeah.
And she really takes that apart too, and you realize the necessity of it.
Yeah. There's in our tape library, there's Mary Hinderly has a tape on the creeds, and she uses Sayers a lot in that one, and that's a very good one to read. This whole thing is based on the Apostle Creed, the Nicene Creed, and the Athanasian Creed, the mind of the maker is. Anything else? Anybody else wishes to contribute to this subject? I think I want to close with one thing while I've got you here. Where is it? If I can find it. I don't know if I can find it here. I can't find it. I can't remember what I did with it. Oh, well, maybe we won't do it then. I think maybe it was one of the letters. Anyway, whatever's right. I hope that you'll be able to... I can't even remember which one it was.
Why isn't Erdman's publishing any more of the letters?
I think it's just in a lull.
Because I wrote them and they just said out of print, period. I mean, you know.
Well, really? Like they, you know.
Just recently. Yeah. And, I mean, that's a fine book.
It is. This is just this.
Understand.
Superb. Roderick Jellema is the editor, and his introduction to Sayers in this book is far better than this biography. So. Oh, one other thing about the biography. Did I tell you? I can't remember. That one reason the biography is so bad is because the author couldn't get much of the information about Sayers, because Sayers had a verbal request that she had made to her family, what little of it there was, and her trustees, you know, and to her publishers and stuff, that she wished, it was not written in her will, but she wished that no biography be written about her until she had been dead for 50 years, which would leave us at the year 2007. But, you know, it's kind of nice to have something, but because of that, and her trustees, and her family, she has one son, her son and her publishers respected that. And this Janet Hitchman, they could not get a word out of him. She got some things out of the BBC, but not even very much. So, well, we'll call it quits. I hope you enjoy reading Sayers.
Thank you.